Hello, I'm Alison Larkin, writer, comedian, narrator, and host of the Jane Austen podcast. Join me as we embark on a journey through Austen's timeless stories, starting with Pride and Prejudice. The Jane Austen podcast with Alison Larkin is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Ugh, another pointless video call where nothing gets done. I think you're on mute, David.
Sorry. What did I miss?
IT just approved Miro for the whole company.
Miro? That's the...
online whiteboard. For team collaboration. We can make these long video meetings so much shorter with Miro boards. We can share ideas, feedback, and updates on them whenever. Actually see what we're talking about.
It's all online.
Miro will make our flexible work setup so much easier. With one virtual space for our brainstorms, projects, presentations.
Oh, that sounds kind of amazing. So I don't need to wake up for 6 a.m. calls with the London office anymore.
Now you're getting it.
Don't let time zones get in the way of your team working well together. See why 99% of the Fortune 100 trust Miro to get good work done from anywhere. Get your first three boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Hey everyone, this is John Rocha, one third of the Geek Buddies, with this awesome ad for you. If you like this show and you want to make your own, and some of you have reached out and asked us about making your own podcast, well, let me tell you about Anchor. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And now you can even add any song from Spotify directly to your episodes. The possibilities are endless for what you can create, whether it's music analysis, your own radio show, or something the world's never heard before. Go ahead and let your freak flag fly. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and so many more places. And you can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Take it from us here at the Geek Buddies. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. Now, on with the Geek Buddies show. Everyone, and welcome to another brand new episode of the
Geek
Buddies. Hey!
Well, we are back again for another week of geeky goodness. Gonna get into so many things here today. I am one of your hosts. I am the Outlaw John Rocha, writer, producer, and host here on the Outlaw Nation channel and the Geek Buddies. And in the middle,
I am Michael Vogel. I am a writer and producer for animated TV shows and movies.
And on the end there.
And this is Shannon McClung. I'm an animation writer and a television actor, where you may have seen me on Silicon Valley, Modern Family, and Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Nice, nice. And today we're getting into a number of things. We'll talk about that Venom, Let There Be Carnage trailer, the Green Knight trailer, some Knives Out 2 casting, some Zack Snyder's news, some He-Man news, some He-Man animation stills that have been dropped. And our main topic today, we'll be getting into this idea that Marvel is kind of moving away from the showrunner status and kind of replacing it with a director head writer kind of combo. Interesting stuff that we're going to get into nuances of here as our main topic. For those of you who are new to the show, thank you so much for taking a chance on us here on the Geek Buddies. For those of you coming back, thank you very much for staying on the Geek Buddies train. The way it works is each of us presents a geek news item. There's three of them. Then we take a little bit of a break and then jump into our main topic. So who's got the first one today?
I think that's me, right?
Yeah, I think it is you. Go! It is you.
Okay. Trailers. So we had two very different trailers dropped this week. The first one, which I'm sure everyone saw at the beginning of the week, was the first look at Venom, Let There Be Carnage, directed by Andy Serkis, the continued adventures of Eddie Brock. This movie was supposed to come out last year originally, and as with all things quarantine, it got pushed. There was a lot of mixed response from the first Venom film. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were excited to see this sort of beloved anti-hero from Marvel Comics finally make his big screen debut. And then when they got it, at least for the Marvel folks, the comic book folks, there was sort of a whereas the regular movie-going audience seemed to really respond to it because it did very, very well. And it even had a little teaser at the end showing Woody Harrelson as Cletus Cassidy, knowing that we were going to get Carnage in the sequel. So now we've seen people heard that Andy Serkis was directing this, like, oh, maybe he's going to come in and write the ship. Based off of this trailer, it seems like, other than getting Woody Harrelson a much better wig, it looks like we're getting more of the same. I have some thoughts about the trailer in general and where the movie could go, but gentlemen, I would love to hear your thoughts first.
Mikey?
I mean, you did a trailer response already, reaction, didn't you, Johnny? I want to hear from you first.
Here's my response to it. Definitely, you're right. Right off the bat, we're like, oh, so they're not walking away from the humor and the awkward humor that you see here and, you know, the weird voice and all of that. They're not walking away from that. Mrs. Chen is in this thing. And we get, Cletus with a better haircut, but we also get Shriek. It was nice to see Naomi Harris just for some snippets, not just teasing it that she's going to be a part of this thing. But there's no real plot that I saw other than Carnage is coming after Venom for whatever reason to prove a point. Once again, and this is standard comic book stuff. You know, the villain breaks out to prove a point about how society is messed up and the world needs to go away. And they go after the hero to prove the point. So that seemed to be the overall reaction. But like, I liked some of the shot. I love the shot of Carnage in full Carnage. That was a great shot. I think there's some good shots in here. So certainly Serkis knows where to place the camera. Cinematography looked good to me. But overall, I feel like we're just getting the same movie again in terms of the style and the atmosphere and the vibe. So whatever people thought was going to be different from Ruben Fleischer to Andy Serkis, I don't see it in the trailer just yet. And maybe there are other trailers coming down the road that'll show me a version of this. Also, or a better version of this. Also, Michelle Williams is in it less than Mrs. Chen. So I think that was really strange overall. What did you think, Mike?
I will say the way that I knew the trailer had dropped is that two different friends of mine texted me the trailer and said, please tell me this is a joke. And then I watched the trailer and I was like, no, that's what's coming. I am not the biggest fan of the first Venom movie. I'm a big fan of Venom as a character. Sure. And yeah, for a lot of people, and I'll just say this right off the bat, like, for a lot of people just seeing Venom on the big screen, they were thrilled. And for a lot of people with this trailer, they were like, I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was great. It was just fucking balls to the wall crazy. I'm here for it. And I completely respect that. Go to the movie, live your dreams. I just don't get it. It just makes Venom so much less cool than I think Venom is to go in this kind of tonal direction. And this is just a bigger, there's no way around this. This is just an issue that Sony has, but there is just a big Spider-Man sized hole in the center of this movie to me. I mean, in the entire franchise, like, you have a giant symbiote that looks like Spider-Man, and now we have Carnage who looks like Spider-Man, and there's no Spider-Man. And they've just sort of avoided the topic of why all these things look like Spider-Man. It's just, well, he does because that's what he looks like. And I just feel like that combined with, like, you know, the whole trailer opens, Venom is just crooning a tune as he makes his breakfast. And all I could think of was Tom Hardy sitting in a lobster tank eating lobster in the first movie. And I was like, this movie is for somebody. I am not that somebody.
I mean, honestly, the trailer started, and as he's making breakfast, I'm laughing. I'm like, yeah, this is like, I have nothing invested in this. So watching this is very funny, especially that shot with the ketchup at the end. I mean, Tom Hardy plays this role very, very well. Again, I was not a big Marvel Comics reader growing up. I was a DC Comics reader. So I don't have the emotional attachment to Venom. I think the version that we're getting is better than what we saw in Spider-Man 3, but that seems like a very low bar to get past. I remember when we watched this movie in the theater, because it was crowded, and people are cracking up. I was sitting next to Kalinowski, and he's looking at me like, what is wrong with these people? And it's just like, well, look, I mean, they kind of went up the center and got the reaction from the movie going public at large. They got the reaction that they wanted, so it's like, why break the formula?
That is true. I mean, I think that, and I think like that there is an inherent issue, and again, this is a Sony issue. Like, I don't know how you work around this, but taking a lot of these characters that were Spidey's villains or our antagonists, and in their very first outing, like we did with Venom 1, making them the anti-hero by the end of the movie, to me, it kind of makes them a little less interesting. Like, and again, I am pitching something that is not possible, that was not in the cards for Marvel and Sony, but had you had Tom Hardy as Eddie Brock going up against a Peter Parker, and then he spun off to become an anti-hero, I think there's more of a story there. So I do think, like, they are sort of hindered by what they are legally allowed to do. But, like, you know, to Shannon's point, Shannon grew up on DC. Like, I'm spoiled. Like, you know, I got to work with the Spectacular Spider-Man team on doing the Eddie Brock story in that and kind of leading to Venom as one of our big bads. And so I think that I sort of have this, that, like, I very much enjoy the Venom story we told in Spectacular Spider-Man. And for me, I'm like, yeah, that's my bar. And if that's my bar, Venom going full moons over Miami is not my jam.
I'm just confused about how you have Spider-Man drawn on the wall in the Morbius trailer, but you have no reference or hint or mention or even the drawing on the wall in the Venom trailer. It just seems odd, you know, especially because that was the big concern, Michael, you expressed it coming out of the first movie. People like, why does he look like Spider-Man? If Spider-Man's not even mentioned, what is the logic here where they're not allowed to mention Spider-Man in any way, shape, or form, or his influence on him, or anything like that? So it just seems odd. And you know they're going to retcon this once Tom Holland swings back over into the Sony universe. If that happens, they'll retcon it that this has always been the issue with Venom, and he will find all that out from Secret Wars or whatever, how they make it work. So that's the disappointing part of it all. But, you know, this is Mikey and Shannon, this is the move. They clearly made $856 million off thing, and they're like, there's nothing to change here. Whereas Suicide Squad made $780 million, and people are like, we can't be having this again. So it's a weird reaction to both situations, to be honest with you. But apparently enough people liked it, whereas Suicide Squad is pretty universally disliked. By people.
It is funny though when you think, I mean, I do, and I think this is an interesting topic, maybe for a whole nother Geek Buddies, but James Gunn's Suicide Squad trailer came out, and it definitely is very tongue-in-cheek, has a lot of humor with King Shark. Like, it's a very funny trailer, and the reaction that we all have is, fuck yeah, that's what I want in a Suicide Squad movie. And the Venom trailer comes out, and in its defense, has a lot of weird, crazy humor, and for whatever reason, I'm curious as to what the difference is. You know, like, why does James Gunn humor in Suicide Squad work, and I can't wait to see that movie? And then I watch this trailer, and I'm like, I don't think so, Andy Serkis. Yeah. I'm just curious, you know, like, I'm curious as to the difference there.
Okay. All right. What else have we got, Shan?
Well, that's going to be coming out in September. And the other trailer that we got this week was The Green Knights, starring Dev Patel. So this is based off the old Arthurian romance. Sir Gawain was a knight of the Round Table, takes on, it looks like, some sort of supernatural creature. Like, I remember there was an old movie, like, back in the 80s that was, I think it was called Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And it was the first time I experienced finding a movie in the video store, the mom and pop video store, in the back row, being like, oh, this looks amazing, putting it in, and it was not so much. But this trailer from David Lowery, really, really interesting visuals. This looks like the art house fantasy movie. But gentlemen, what did you think?
I loved it. I love the Arthurian stuff. It's one of those sections of legend that I love to go back to, but they rarely get it right on screen, right? Excalibur's probably, you could argue, the best King Arthur story ever told. That's 1981. So it's kind of crazy to think about that. Of course, some people argue Sword in the Stone. I totally respect that. But I know. To me, it's Excalibur. But they've tried how many times? You know, First Knight, the other one with Clive Owen. That was, you know,
King Arthur.
Yeah, King Arthur. Like, it's just like, you get to the point where it's like, how come you can't get this right? This is so good. How can you not get this right? And this looks awesome. The kind of crazy, if you go back and read the original source material, it's pretty nutty. Like, the original that they wrote way back in the olden days, like, it's nutty how it's the experiences they put these knights through and their different adventures. and Sir Gawain. This is an interesting one, and I love the look of the Green Knight. I love the otherworldly aspect of this without seeming like it's like too fantastical. It still feels somewhat grounded, and it's this guy trying to prove himself to his uncle, who is the king, and he goes on this crazy quest. What is he going to discover about himself? Even with talking foxes and tall, bald-looking weird things, I still think it's grounded in the adventure because of where it's set, which is a nutty time in the world, apparently. So I like it. I loved it. What did you all think?
John, what do you think of the trailer? It was nutty, man. It was crazy. I was just it's wild. I loved it. I loved it. A couple things. One, to Shannon's point about finding movies in the 80s, the one thing I loved about this trailer is it gave me super fantasy 80s movie vibes. Like, the 80s fantasy movies were just balls to the wall weird. Excalibur being one of them. But, you know, everything from Labyrinth to Dark Crystal to Neverending Story to Crawl to everything. Like, the 80s was a time where, like, Star Wars had come out in 77 and had changed cinema forever. And everyone else was like, well, fuck, man. I guess people are into the weird shit. And we got a bunch of weird shit. And those were the movies that we kind of all grew up on. And so seeing this trailer that was just super out there, I was like, I don't know what the fuck this is, but I am in. And it also, to your point, Johnny, about all of the versions of movies that deal with King Arthur and Camelot and Excalibur and Once and Future King as sort of the source material, I think that where a lot of them made mistakes was they kept trying to ground it and get rid of the sorcery and get rid of the weirder stuff and get rid of the magic. And said, let's tell a very human story about Arthur and Lancelot and Guinevere. And this is like, no, dude, it's a talking tree and a talking fox and some giant bald people, and you're on for the ride. And I think that that's what a lot of the cinematic versions of King Arthur are missing out on, because that's what we all loved about it. Like, when you were a kid and you heard these stories about Arthur and the Lady in the Lake and Excalibur and all this stuff, like, there was a level, and Merlin, I mean, there was a level of magic to it that made it sort of enchanting. And this movie feels enchanting. Like, this, like, that's the only word I could use. I was like, yeah, like, that fox started talking and I'm like, well, I'm fucking in 1,000% of this movie.
What'd you think, Shan?
You know, when we saw the first trailer for this that came out over a year ago, and it was a teaser, it reminded me of the Fassbender Macbeth movie. I'm like, this looks super artsy.
Great point.
Which I don't necessarily think is a bad thing. It's neither a good thing nor a bad thing. I'm just like, oh, this looks very upper crust. But then watching this one, it still has that flavor. It still has that kind of very artistic imagery, but at the same time, you're getting more of those fantastical elements, you know, the tree, the fox. It looks super fun, and in a summer where we're going to be getting a glut of movies, I think this one will probably stand out a little bit because it's just different enough.
It seems like they also spent money on this one too, and the fact that A24 did not sell this to Amazon or to Netflix, or they clearly think this is a film that deserves a film release and maybe consideration for Oscars or whatever. So they want people to see it on screen and spend some money on it. Also, Shannon, Gawain and the Green Knight is from 1973. I think that's the one you watched growing up. Gawain was Murray Head, who sings the song One Night at Bangkok. It's a weird little world.
Oh my gosh. He's got a red Dutch boy wig on. I mean,
yes, that's it. That's
nutty, man. It's nutty.
Nutty, man.
It was one of the first movies I watched that, just because it's on screen doesn't mean it's good.
Right.
It just ends.
Right on.
But before we move on, we do have some Knives to Cast.
When is Green Knight coming up?
July 30th.
Yeah, July 30th. Get on.
But before, I know we're already behind, but we do have some quick Knives to Casting news that Dave Bautista, Ed Norton, and Janelle Monáe have all joined Daniel Craig in Greece filming Knives Out 2. So curious to see who else is going to be signing on for this movie. I still wish it was going to be in the big screen. but I understand the dollars and signs, the dollar signs in, you know, in the Netflix deal.
Yeah,
but
what was it, 400, was it 450 million that they paid? Or?
Yeah, for part two and part three.
Yep. Yeah.
Crazy amount of money. But what do we think of the expanding cast of Knives Out 2?
Mikey?
I mean, I would have been excited with none of this news. I just recently rewatched Knives Out, and it's just such a fantastic movie. It's so great. It's so funny. And I think if Rian Johnson can continue to tell movies in that tone with that humor and make them compelling whodunits the way that Knives Out is, I'm super on board. I love the way that he uses so many big name actors in the first, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis and Toni Collette and everyone else, like, for maximum effect. Each one of them comes in, Chris Evans, and they each just get to chew the fuck out of the scenery because the characters are so over the top. So looking at Norton, Janelle Monáe, Bautista, these are people who are going to be very striking and very different on screen. So you can see that he is assembling another, big star-studded cast to just like be as over the top as possible. I hope they can come close to being as amazing as both Jamie Lee Curtis and Toni Collette are in the first one, because especially on a rewatch, those two killed me.
Yeah, I love this casting as well. Yet another step forward for Bautista as an actor, you know, coming into these franchises. He's the kind of guy you get in the franchise, but doesn't take away from the other actors. And by that, I mean, he's such a big guy, he's hard to ignore. If you cast The Rock, it would be all about The Rock. But with Bautista, he's such a consummate actor that he slides into these roles, does such a great job in these franchises, and slides right on out. So it's nice to see him kind of be a part of this. I'm excited about this. I would love it if they cast Pierce Brosnan, and it's Pierce Brosnan versus Daniel Craig trying to figure out who the real murderer is in all of this. That would be such a meta badass moment to have, or storyline to have.
That would be amazing. I do hope, I mean, not, I wouldn't say this is a concern of mine, but something that I really do hope is that what's great about the first Knives Out movie is, as much as it is a really fun, ridiculous, compelling whodunit, and Daniel Craig is hilarious, it's also this really interesting movie that talks about how people on the right and people on the left are both equally ridiculous, and it actually is a really interesting movie about sort of where we are in the world today as a society. And I hope that the second movie, the third movie, I hope that Rian Johnson continues to make these sort of social commentaries as well as creating a really funny, compelling mystery.
Absolutely.
If you guys were going to have one person to add to this cast off the top of your heads, who would it be?
I already had mine. So, Mikey, your turn.
Ooh, Sally Field. Just because. I was recently in a voice record for a project I'm working on, and the actress, like, I was trying to get her to like do like a big freak out with like tons of emotions, and I was like, okay, I don't know if you're gonna get this note. Can you just Sally Field this? Like, I need 12 emotions. I need 12 emotions in 10 seconds. And she was like, oh, like Sally Field in the funeral scene in Steel Magnolias. I'm like, that is what I want. And she did it. And that is the energy that I would like Sally Field to bring into Knives Out 2, were she ever to be considered.
What about you, Shen? Do you have
probably like Morgan Freeman.
Oh,
I think Morgan Freeman in a movie like this would be really, really funny, because Morgan Freeman is hilarious. And if with the right role, I think Rian Johnson would really be able to pull a fun performance out of him for something like this.
Nice. All right. So we'll see when that's coming out, but certainly on Netflix. Let's move on. Mikey, what have you got?
Well, look, we covered 80s sword and sorcery. We covered star-studded casts. This next bit of news that just dropped is all of that. We've all known that Netflix has a Kevin Smith He-Man series animated coming soon. But Entertainment Weekly, as of us recording this, just dropped a ton of new images and a ton of new information about this new Kevin Smith He-Man Masters of the Universe series. And it looks bonkers. It picks up exactly where the classic 80s animated series left off. It takes all of the characters that we know and sort of, according to Kevin Smith, really pushes them in directions that we've not seen before. And the cast is just absolutely awesome. Chris Wood from Supergirl is the voice of He-Man, Prince Adam. Mark Hamill is Skeletor. Lena Headey is Evil-Lyn. Sarah Michelle Gellar is Teela. Alicia Silverstone is Queen Marlena. Kevin Conroy is Merman. Let's see, who else do we have? Original Skeletor Alan Oppenheimer is the voice of Mossman now. And rounding out the cast, we've got
Kevin Michael Richardson.
Kevin Michael Richardson is Beastman. Yeah. Liam Cunningham is Man-at-Arms. Griffin Newman is Orko. Stephen Root as Cringer. Diedrich Bader as King Randor. Henry Rollins as Triclops. Susan Eisenberg as Sorceress. Yeah. Phil LaMarr as Hero. Kree Summer as Priestess. It is absolutely out of control. There's some more information about the story, but before we even like get into that, what do you guys think about all this?
Look, I'm 100% on board with this. A, because Kevin Smith's involved in it, but B, because I have a couple of friends in this. Susan Eisenberg, who I got to know doing voiceovers over at William Morris, is such a fan of her and her Wonder Woman work, so nice to see her stepping into this. And in EW, I don't know if anybody's watching, you misspelled her name. It's not Susan Eisenberg. It's Susan Eisenberg, you sons of bees. And also, Tiffany Smith, who gave... I know Christian walked me into this business, but it's Tiffany Smith who taught me this business way back when in 2015. And so when she was getting into voiceover, because I've been doing it, we had one-on-one sessions a number of times to help her get ready to do animation voiceovers. So to see her blowing up like this, I take a certain level, small amount of pride, because she's such a talented person and such a nice person and an awesome person. So amidst all the great actors that are involved with this, I have a personal joy that two of my friends are in this as well, getting involved in it. So I'm excited for it overall. And the images look awesome. Look, I wasn't going to be on board with this. I was like, He-Man, it's cool. I'm happy for my friends. But seeing the imagery, I'm like, maybe I'll give this one a shot because I like the largest. I'm a big image guy, so I like the larger shot. I like the shadows on the muscles. I'm a fan of that kind.
Well, and they seem to have fixed one of the most sort of egregious errors from the old 80s series was that the difference between Prince Adam and He-Man was a white shirt and a purple vest. Yeah. The image of Prince Adam that they have, he's tiny, he's scrawny. So there's definitely, you can see the transition from that guy to that guy. But also on the writing side, I mean, yes, Kevin Smith is running the show. Mark Bernardin, his faithful co-host on the podcast. Also, our buddy Tim Sheridan. Our buddy Tim Sheridan's in the room.
Third friend on this, yeah.
Writing on this. So, yeah, I mean, Masters of the Universe was always like the second or third 80s property that I liked. I liked Transformers. I liked G.I. Joe. And then Masters of the Universe was kind of third. And then looking at these images and the quotes that Kevin Smith has, it's like, you know, we want to take this world. Don't change anything about the world. Don't make fun of it. Don't wink at it. Like treat it like Shakespeare. Yeah. Take these larger than life characters, but talk about real human problems and real human challenges. I'm like, oh, that's such an interesting way to attack this property. And knowing that Noah Centineo is no longer playing He-Man in the live action version, it looks like this is the one that's going to be the first of the races.
He-Man was my first, near and dear to my heart. Like, it was the first 80s show I fell in love with. It's the first 80s sort of toys, action figures that I was obsessed with. Good chance it made me gay. Let's just put that out there. It's a high likelihood. So I'm super stoked because for me, as much as you go back and watch the old He-Man cartoons and you're like, holy crap, this is rough stuff. To me, this whole world of Eternia, this world that sort of blended, whereas Star Wars blended sort of fantasy and sci-fi elements in more of a sci-fi world, He-Man took sci-fi and fantasy elements and put them in a very, very typically fantasy world. Castles and magic and swords and sorcery. And I ate it all up. So, I mean, I was obsessed. I had all the toys. My parents got tired of buying every playset and vehicle for me. But, like, I got them all. So, you know, I definitely take it really seriously. And that quote that you had is when Kevin Smith is talking about, you know, speaking of buddies, and we have a bunch of buddies, as Roka and you were saying, like, Tim on the writing side, a bunch of people on the acting side, and Ted Biaselli, who is the Netflix executive that was covering the show, also a really good friend of ours. And he was the one that Smith says, said to him, do me a favor. When I used to watch the shows as a kid, I legitimately thought He-Man was on the verge of getting killed. I believed in the stakes. Make me believe in that again. People see this as goofy IP, but there's this rich tapestry, a world of characters. Please don't talk down to it. Mm-hmm. Don't make fun of it. Don't wink. Like Shannon said, just treat it as Shakespeare. Yeah. And I worked with Ted at the Hub and Hasbro. I've known Ted a long time. And that is how he sees this. And what's really great is that based on what Kevin Smith said, everybody from the actors involved to the writing staff, to the writing team, to the executives like Ted at Netflix, all wanted to treat this seriously. So I'm really curious to see. One of the other tidbits about story that actually has me really, really intrigued that the EW story talks about is that they're doing the first five episodes premiere in July, and then the next five episodes or part two come later, and that it kind of picks up where we left off with He-Man, but then some cataclysmic event happens that sort of shakes things up with all the characters. And one of the things that they did reveal is, you know, in classic He-Man lore, only certain people know the secret that Prince Adam is He-Man. And we've built our entire story on who was left out of that secret and the damaging trickle effects that that has. It's a story about a hero who has to live under deception in order to protect those he loves. And it's about how that deception rots at the core. So that's like some pretty heavy ideas. I mean, I know that's true. Were just talking in our Invincible spoiler review about... what it was like, Mark having a secret identity and trying to date. And we had some debate about like, what's the right way to handle being a superhero in a relationship. And it sounds like He-Man is going to kind of cover a little bit of that territory too, as far as like, you know, there was a lot of people in his life, his parents, Teela, a lot of people that didn't know this secret. And if they're going to delve into that, that's going to be super interesting.
Yeah, and as a counterpoint, it may have turned Michael gay, but it turned me straight with some of these shows. I mean, come on already. This is just incredibly attractive people for sure. And I love this shot of the whole crew here as well. And I do want to give one more shout out. That's the Griffin Newman, who is playing Orko, I think, on the side there. Griffin was our first choice this year, first draft pick in the Schmodown. He is on our crew. He had a match already. He is a guy, a very nice guy. Obviously, people know him from The Tick and whatever, but just incredibly awesome dude, and he's been great. He knows so much about movies, and his podcast about movies is incredible as well. So many great talents being brought together for this. It's exciting. Plus, Liam Cunningham, for God's sakes, from Game of Thrones. So it's nice to see him in this thing. Mikey, so when's it coming exactly, Mike? What's the date for this? Have they said when in July yet or no?
July 23rd, part one premiere. So the first five episodes. And I have a feeling that people are going to absolutely eat it up. So I cannot wait.
Agreed. Let's go to another property with big, muscly dudes, and that's Justice League. Zack Snyder here. I know some of you are like, oh, Zack Snyder again. Well, Zack Snyder had some comments here because promoting Army of the Dead, which is coming out in theaters this weekend as we're recording it, but then next week drops on Netflix. I was not able to secure an early screening of this. I didn't work hard enough to get it, and I guess was caught up with other things. So I may sneak out to a movie theater this weekend and watch it, because I am looking forward to this one like crazy. But he was interviewed on this show, Jake's Takes, hosted by Jake Hamilton, and he was asked about the Warner Brothers situation and the reaction to his Justice League and what it might mean for the future for his Snyderverse. And he said, Warner Brothers has been aggressively anti-Snyder, if you will. What can I say? Clearly, they're not interested in my take, but I would also say that they certainly weren't interested in, I would have said originally, in my take on Justice League. They certainly made decisions about that. I love the characters and I love the worlds, and I think it's an amazing place to make a movie. It's glorious IP. So there's that. I don't know what could be done as you go forward, other than I think the fan movement is so strong and the fan community, their intention is so pure, and I really have this huge respect for it. I would hope that cooler heads would prevail with the studio and they would see that there's this massive fandom that wants more of that, but who knows what they'll do. And this all gets dropped amidst this controversy about whether HBO Max has been releasing the numbers or not, whether Zack Snyder's Justice League really led to an increase in subscribers. Certainly there was an increase, but a lot of people were speculating that it wasn't the increase that they were hoping for or they had intended to have. And of course, Deborah Snyder coming out saying as well that, look, it doesn't matter how we drop our movies, as long as we get our movies out to as many people as possible. That's what we've kind of changed our mindset about. So a lot of conversation about this with the Snyderverse. Certainly it's been a campaign, but I have not felt, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but I have not felt that it has been as powerful of a drumbeat as it was for Zack Snyder's Justice League to come out. And that may be because Warner Brothers has gone into overdrive trying to downplay Zack Snyder's Justice League. Mikey, what do you think? You're the anti, sort of anti-Snyder guy on this thing. Do you think he's trying to subtly push and restore the Snyderverse movement again?
I mean, he's doing exactly what he did with the Snyder Cut originally, which is drop a comment here, drop a wink and a nudge there. You know, at a certain point, I do feel like it's sort of like he's egging fans on for something that I think the difference, to your point, with the Snyder Cut versus now is the Snyder Cut was a thing that existed. Kevin Smith came out early on, said he had seen parts of it. Like, there was a there. There was something that existed. This Snyder Universe thing is more of like a, hey, we want you, Warner Brothers, to give Zack Snyder, to give Zack the keys to the kingdom again. Yeah. And we want to see his whole universe. We want you to just pay millions of dollars in multiple movies to see this thing completed. And you're just kind of like, where does this end, really? with the Justice League movie, there was this movie was going into production. Some shit went down. Yeah. Everybody agrees that what we got wasn't good. Wouldn't it be great to see what it was originally meant to be? And so that was something that, whether you agreed with it, which, you know, you did, and or you didn't agree with it, which I did, there was an end goal there. There was let's let this actual movie as it was meant to be come out. Saying his whole comment, well, I guess they just don't like the Snyder Universe. Yeah, they don't. They've basically said that. They didn't like it when it was happening, and they were concerned about it, and that's one of the reasons that he was miserable directing the movie, because Warner Brothers at that point was like, this is too serious, this is too this, this is not what we want. And so I just think the whole thing is a little odd, and it's like, yeah, let's just move on. Let's just move on to something new.
Okay. What side are you on this, Shannon? Because, you know, the studio side has been very clear about it, and Sarnoff doing that interview Monday morning after the Snyder Cut had been released. Then they dropped that 4K trailer of Joss Whedon's Justice League, and it's like, dude, Joss Whedon is pretty much persona non grata. What are you doing? So it seems, and of course, they still keep the characters from the Snyderverse, though, right? Momoa is still Aquaman. Gal Gadot's still Wonder Woman. There are a number of people that are still involved in this Snyderverse. And that new Batman trailer certainly feels as dark as anything Snyder was going to do. So you wonder, like, do they just not like working with him? Or do they feel like, we've got to stop this now because it's never going to end? If we ask him to come back and do more movies, then he'll be like, let me do some more movies, and it'll never end. Do you think they're just going to take the hit on this?
I look at it from two points of view. One, I didn't listen to the interview. So tone is a big thing. And one, he was there promoting Army of the Dead.
Yeah, yeah.
He responded to a question that was asked. Now, if he had not asked that question, would he have tried to steer the interview towards restore the Snyder Cut? I highly doubt it. I think he was responding honestly. Like, yeah, they're anti-Snyder. And again, it's not it's how he said it. Does it sound like he's banging on the pulpit, shouting to the back row? My guess is no. I think he probably responded as casually as one can, and he's speaking his truth. He's just like, look, they're anti-Snyder. They didn't want to do any more of what I did. I would love to do more, but it doesn't. Hold on. But from the other side, like, at this point, yeah, why doesn't he let it go? Because the studio more than likely is not going to double down on the Snyderverse. Mm-hmm. You know, they haven't said how well Zack Snyder's Justice League did. Are they trying to downplay the numbers that it did better than they say? I don't know. I mean, at the end of the day, Warner Brothers is a business. And I think if they could see a path to make more money, like, oh my gosh, the fans absolutely want more Zack Snyder, I think they would do it. Mm-hmm. But at this point, it doesn't seem like they see that as a financially successful path.
Yeah, Mikey, what were you saying?
So one counterpoint to that, I think you do make a good point. I think he didn't bring it up. He was asked about it. He's going to respond to it. I think that that is a very fair statement. There's been a lot of articles written, and even Zack Snyder has said, like, Zack Snyder is aware that there is a portion of the Snyder fans online, not all Snyder fans by any stretch, but there is a portion that are a little bit toxic. And Zack Snyder has freely admitted this. Like, he's discussed this. I think that when you're asked about what do you think about the Snyderverse, what do you think about the release of the Snyderverse, to even say Warner Brothers is anti-Snyder, you're egging the fans on a little bit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think that there is an element to, there is a way to answer that in typical, like, Hollywood, like, hey, I was so thrilled that I got to make my Justice League movie. Obviously, we talked about the other movies that we could make. It doesn't seem like Warner Brothers wants to go in that direction, but I'm super excited that I get to do movies like Army of the Dead, and you wait till you guys see what we have coming up next. There is a way to sort of sidestep that question and kind of, like, do it, and to kind of go full in and go, I guess Warner Brothers is anti-Snyder, knowing that you have portions of your fan base that are going to eat that up, I think it is a little bit egging people on.
Do you think that was deliberate, though? Do you think, like, because again, he's answering stuff off the cuff.
Yes and no, right? Oh, sorry, Mike, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, well, I think Johnny and I are going to say the same thing, which is, given everything that he did with his fans throughout the release, the Snyder Cut, which to good effect, he got the movie made. I think he absolutely knows what he's doing when he says that stuff. He's sort of become the master of egging fans on online. And I'm not saying that even necessarily all of it in a bad way, but every mention of, oh, well, I was gonna do Martian Manhunter, but I guess we'll never see it. Oh, too bad about this. Like, he for sure is very adept at social media.
Yeah, and I think this is why Warner Brothers hesitates to work with him again, because he does, like, take the shots when the shots are presented, and they're subtle shots, but then he walks them back, because within the same five sentences, he says, I guess they're anti-Snyderverse, and then he says, but it's a great place to be, and it's got great IP, and I love making movies there, you know, so he's checking all the boxes, catering to all the sides in this argument, and as Mikey said, that is smart. Certain people know how to play this thing like a fiddle, and he does. I'm not saying he's playing the fans or anything like that. I'm not trying to disrespect the fans who are behind the Restore the Snyderverse. And I totally respect that, because fans are allowed to ask for what they want, obviously. And he owes them, because they were a massive reason why this happened. He was able to finish his movie and get it out there. And people, for the most part, really liked it so much more than the original Justice League that was out there. So in a way, he has to cater to them by saying, yeah, there's some great people in this movement. I love this movement, the fans and everything like that. And the studio's anti-Snyderverse, and they're moving, you know, but they, you know, we'll see what they do with that. And when he said cooler heads need to prevail, I don't think it's about cooler heads. I think Warner Brothers is like, we just don't want to be in business with this guy anymore because of what happened with the fans and whatever. And we'll take the hits, but we're moving on, and people need to get on board, because we're not going back to Snyder anytime soon. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You've got a right, it's your business. You've got a right to work with who you want to work with. And if it doesn't work out with this guy, you got a right to move on and create what you want to create out of what he put at the studio. They have a right to move on with Momoa. They have a right to move on with Gal Gadot. They have everywhere. So I was in the Restore the Snyder Cut, definitely movement, but as for Restore the Snyderverse, I'm not in that movement as strongly, because I'm like, he got his cut and that's what we wanted. Now you're pushing for more and the studio is not going to do it. So no matter how much you yell, the studio is just going to move on. It's not, there's no point to it, you know?
And just to be clear, I think it maybe has less to do with the studio doesn't want to work with Zack Snyder, or the studio has any kind of concern about the fan base. I think the studio has been pretty clear from Batman versus Superman on that vision is not what they're about. So that's when fair. He says they're anti-Snyder, or anti-Snyderverse, not anti-Snyder, I think that the studio creatively, like, not having nothing to do with everything around it, I think the studio creatively is not about the Snyderverse. I think they don't want to go in that direction with their heroes. They have other plans and other things that they want to do.
Yeah.
Whether they're right or wrong remains to be seen.
Right. And it's, as I said, it's the studio and it's their right. So we shall see. But I'm looking forward to Army of the Dead. It looks awesome. Dave Bautista stepping in again. So maybe I'll sneak out and see it around here somewhere. Or maybe I'll drive up and Shannon and Mike have some time. We'll see. Anyway, let's take a quick break. And then we're going to jump into our main topic, talking a little bit about Marvel TD and how they're kind of sort of semi-revolutionizing the game on the TV side of things. We'll be right back right after this. All right, let's get into our main topic. Mikey, you sent this article to us. Please explain it and talk about it, what we're going to get into here.
Yeah, well, so Variety recently had an article about Marvel Studios and Disney Plus and all of the series that they're doing and how Marvel is doing things a little bit differently on the TV side than most other people do. And that is the fact that they don't use showrunners. So, you know, for people that aren't necessarily completely entrenched in the entertainment industry, TV shows have showrunners. It's like sort of, it's bigger than your head writer. It's a writer that kind of runs the entire ship. Like they're making all the creative decisions on the show. They're kind of calling all the shots. The Ryan Murphys of the world, the Shonda Rhimes of the world, you know, those names that you've heard that you know that get big deals at Netflix, like they are showrunners. Like Shonda Rhimes was the showrunner of Scandal or Grey's Anatomy. Ryan Murphy was the showrunner. Runner of Glee. So these are the people that are like the creative voices that are directing the ship and doing it. And when you are a writer on the TV side of things, like that's your ultimate what you want. You want to show run a series. You want to be the big boss that's kind of this is my vision. This is where I'm going. This is what I'm doing. Now, Marvel, when Comic-Con a few years back, the last Comic-Con that we all remember from the days of war.
85 years ago.
And it's been so long. When Kevin Feige came out, and at least the way the Daily Variety article kicks off, they kind of reveal that when he came out and was announcing the creative teams for all the Marvel shows, he very specifically did not use the term showrunner. He used the term head writer. And in the terms of Marvel, whether it be Jack Schaefer, whether it be Malcolm Spellman on Falcon Winter Soldier, they are referred to as the head writers, not showrunners. They don't have that showrunner role. And the reason that the article kind of goes into in more detail that they're not doing that is because they're treating these, as Kevin Feige said, even if it's a TV series that's 9 episodes or 6 episodes, they're still using sort of the movie format. And on the movie side, the director tends to be the big voice, as we all know, whether it is a Zack Snyder film or a Spielberg film or a Nora Ephron film or pick any director. In the world of movies, the director kind of calls all the shots over the writer. And so on these Marvel TV series, the directors on the shows are kind of given a little bit of an equal weight with the head writer. And then, of course, you have Kevin Feige and Marvel executives who are kind of acting as the big creative stewards and showrunners who are making a lot of those big decisions because all of these TV shows sort of tie into the bigger Marvel universe. So that is a big difference. And what the Daily Variety article goes into is that that's causing a lot of concern in the industry as far as writers and people saying that, you know, at some point, this is one of the quotes from the article is, at some point, this is going to bite Marvel in the ass when it comes to recruiting top shelf writer talent. If you're a mid-level writer getting a giant bump to run a Marvel show, that's great. But if you're an experienced showrunner with multiple shows under your belt, are you going to work under those conditions? Probably not. Or another Emmy award-winning writer who remains nameless in the article says, I'll never work on a TV show for Marvel. They do have a showrunner. It's Kevin Feige. That's fine. I just don't want to work on it. That's all. So it's pretty interesting. Like, if you are into the way that these things get made, it's interesting because on the one hand, you do have a lot of writers and the WGA saying that the way Marvel's doing it is concerning. But on the other hand, I don't think we can argue with the fact that the Marvel shows, at least thus far with WandaVision and Falcon and Winter Soldier and with Loki coming up and What If and Ms. Marvel and everything else that's coming along, they seem to be working. So although it does cause some writers and people in the entertainment community concern, what do you guys think about the way that Marvel is structuring things? And do you think this is smart on their part to try and change the way TV shows are going? Or do you think it's going to bite them in the ass, as one writer said?
Sure. I don't think it's going to bite them in the ass at all. I think whoever said that is maybe inflating their own importance a tad, that there are a lot of writers. There's a lot of good writers, and they don't necessarily need the person that has showrun 12 series. They probably don't want that because, as the one source pointed out, the showrunner is Kevin Feige. I mean, if you watch the end credits for a television show, there's no showrunner credit.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a title. I mean, most showrunners are executive producers, and they also write episodes of the show. So for the Writers Guild to get involved, it's just like, what's your argument here? Like, there's no precedent for this, at least from my point of view. Now, in terms of like whether or not you want to work for Marvel, you know, that's your choice. My guess is that Jack Schaefer and Malcolm Spellman are enjoying quite a few meetings because of how their products turned out. And like you can argue that maybe WandaVision turned out a little bit better than Falcon and Winter Soldier, but I guarantee Malcolm Spellman, along with potentially writing Captain America 4, my guess is he's getting a lot of calls right now. Mm-hmm. So I think this is kind of, these sources are kind of saying something from a place of fear that there is this very successful entity that dictates how they have to do it and they don't want to do it. And the entity is like, great, someone else will.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a writer. You guys both have written on shows, Mikey, show run shows or, you know, what have you. And so I don't have the experience you gentlemen do have in the trenches doing this kind of thing. But on the outside looking in, to me, this is the natural order of things. Progress, the only constant in life is change and progress. And in their minds, Kevin Feige is the essential showrunner and movie runner of the entire universe. And he's got an incredible track record from which to say, like, he can throw that on the table, a book this size, and be like, what are you bringing? Oh, you showrun Scrubs? Cool. Like, it's just a whole different situation you're dealing with here. So, in my mind, and nothing against Bill.
Bill Russell?
Who does a great job with Ted Lasso, but you don't bring in Scrubs and Ted Lasso to me and comparing it to what I've done in the Marvel Universe. So, to me, I think this is the reason Feige allowed these TV shows to connect, where he didn't allow the Marvel Netflix stuff, didn't allow Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. to really technically connect to the overall universe, because he has a story he wants to tell. He believes that he is the guy who understands how to tell these stories best. And the people that work under him, just like Coogler and Taika Waititi, all these people who have worked under him to create these films and these TV shows, Malcolm Spellman, Jack Schaefer, they understand the situation walking in. So that unnamed writer that says, I will never write for a Marvel show, knock yourself out. There's a million other writers waiting right behind you who are just as damn good. We're going to step in, take your spot, and go into that position. So to me, I get the anger, and I get WGA pushing back because that's what they got to do to protect their people. But I also understand this is a unique situation. I don't know this is going to change the way things are. This is just a unique situation because Feige is very much in charge of this. And no one complains that he's some kind of asshole taskmaster like Scott Rudin or anybody else that's, or Weinstein or whatever those jerk-offs were. He's doing his own thing, but everyone says he's a pretty great guy to work with. So,
yep. Well, it's interesting because it's not just the Feige of it all. It's also the fact that the directors are given more weight than directors are given sometimes on others. Like Kari Skogland was kind of covering it on the Falcon and Winter Soldier front.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, it's a nuance, but it's one that I think is being embraced more and more because the job, honestly, in these big epic miniseries or shows is too big. I was in the writer's room so that I could really absorb what was being said and be part of that process by floating ideas. As we were going through production, we would workshop scenes and then ask for rewrites on things. So Spellman was still very much a part of the whole process. It's slightly different the way it all comes down, but it's very effective and efficient because these Marvel things are just too much for any one person. So I think two different things. I do think it's very different than how live action TV works. But I also think, and I know this because I remember when the Marvel movies were first coming out, like Phase 1, I remember Marvel kind of had a reputation where the directors that were coming in, they were meeting with a lot of big name directors, and a lot of the directors on the film side were like, I don't know that I want to do this. I have to like be a part of this Marvel machine. I just think mostly well documented is Edgar Wright and Ant-Man.
Right.
Is the most well-documented one where he and Feige and the Marvel team clearly didn't see eye to eye and he left. But I think that I think you can say fairly that the early Marvel films all kind of do have a little bit of a sameness to them from a visual style and directing standpoint. But then to your point, you look at where Marvel is now with the Russo brothers, with Taika Waititi, with James Gunn, with Ryan Coogler, like with Chloe Zhao, like where they're really kind of, they are attracting top name Oscar winning talent to direct those
younger
movies.
Talent
and younger talent, and all those directors to your point are going on to do a bunch of other things because, you know, Taika Waititi did Thor 3 and everybody was like, holy shit, and then went on to do Jojo Rabbit and all these other things. So I think your point about Jack Schaefer, Malcolm Spellman kind of becoming like geek household names as they run these shows, that even though they aren't the showrunner, even though they do have to sort of be a part of this more collaborative process creatively than like a lot of TV showrunners are used to, they are coming out of this looking pretty good. And I think also for me, the animation process on TV, the TV animation process, you do tend to work more collaboratively. You know, Shannon and I are working on a project right now, and we just had a writer's summit virtually, and I invited our two directors into the room. And so it was kind of similar to what they're talking about here. And for a lot of writers, that's not their jam, and I totally respect that. But I think that my experience in animation kind of pluses it. So I understand the concern. I've talked to a lot of our executive friends. This has come up even before this article came out, where they're like, do you know they don't call them showrunners? And it does kind of make everyone a little bit tentative. Like, I don't know if I think that's a great idea. But I kind of tend to agree with you guys that it seems to be working. And I think that the writers coming out of it, as long as everyone else in the industry understands that head writer at Marvel basically means showrunner with directors in the room, I don't think it's going to hurt people's careers moving forward. So it's interesting, though. It's interesting to see how Marvel has sort of changed the way movies are made, and now they're diving into the TV side and doing the same thing.
And it doesn't really seem like obviously a lot of studios tried to replicate the cinematic formula that Marvel has succeeded with in spades. But TV is a completely different, it's a completely different game. I mean, you have so many platforms for where you can watch a television show. Like the closest that I think you can compare it to is the CW DC shows. And their Berlanti is kind of the guy, but with network, you're producing so much more. What Marvel is doing, they are basically making one big 6-hour movie. Yeah. And they're having the same director. Like in a normal television environment, you have a different director every week. And I mean, Kalinowski is working on a show right now, and he and I were having a conversation yesterday. He's just like, wow. He's like, the directors, they kind of treat them like just another actor. I mean, you have the small trailer. Like you're there for 5 days. You're there for 8 days. And then you're on to another thing. I mean, a lot of times the directors are kind of, for broadcast TV, are kind of hired guns.
Yeah, yeah.
And movies are where the director can really, that's the director's medium. Television has always been the writer's medium, but what Feige and Marvel are doing isn't normal television. I mean, it's something completely different.
That's an excellent point. They're bringing the movie-making approach to television, but it's because these are the kind of television shows they want to do. You know, go back to my earlier point, that's what makes it unique. So people bristling at it who are outside of the Marvel thing, I understand the bristling, because there's a provinciality between writers and directors, and ne'er the twain shall meet sometimes. And I get it. Directors sometimes like being hired guns. I don't want to take responsibility for the overall story. I'm going to get this job, make my money, roll on out to the next show, and make my money there. I totally get that. But there are directors, as Michael stated, there are directors and writers who actually want to be collaborative, who actually want to work together so they can take pride about the overall vision, you know? And the showrunner gets so much credit. If you're kind of having a couple of people involved in this, it allows the credit to be shared and people feel more of an ownership of the overall product. And I don't think that's a negative, to be honest with you. But that being said, both WandaVision and Falcon and Winter Soldier both felt a little bit at the end like a letdown for some people. So do we think the showrunner aspect of this all, maybe having that missing, was a reason for them not 100% sticking that landing on both of these shows? Is that a possibility, an indirect result of this decision? Or am I off base?
I think that you're not off base, that people seemed a little bit let down by those final few episodes. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that's a showrunner issue, because kind of to Shannon's point, what Marvel is getting by bringing the director up and getting rid of that showrunner level, having a head writer, is you're creating this creative team that is making the movie, basically, in the way that they're looking at it. I think that Marvel might have an issue with landing that third act, that third act in your movie kind of action sequence in a big, compelling way, and they haven't quite gotten there yet, and maybe with Loki they will, we'll see. But if you had, to Shannon's point, if you just had a director of the week each week, I don't think that would have solved for that problem.
I agree.
Think you still would have had, like, this is what the ending of WandaVision is, like it or not. And I think also, and I think Shannon has brought this up a few times, I think you both have brought this up, you know, both Falcon and Winter Soldier and WandaVision, particularly when you watch the Falcon and Winter Soldier assembled behind the scenes thing on Disney Plus that they dropped, they both suffered from COVID. You know, like, I'm not saying that the endings of both of those shows would have been drastically different and everybody would have been satisfied had there not been a pandemic. But both shows definitely took some hits for the pandemic. And so it's not until we get to sort of Miss Marvel and Moon Knight and this next batch of Marvel shows that we're going to see, okay, well, do they stick the landing? And so it'll be interesting.
And also, there is something to be said for the television format is new to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, you look at phase one, I mean, Iron Man was great. Iron Man 2, not so much. I mean, it wasn't until they got into like phase two and phase three that they really started to hit those kind of repeat home runs. And something that the article had mentioned is like, at the benefit of having a showrunner is at the end of the day, you might have a head writer and you might have a director and there might be a creative disagreement. And you need someone who is empowered to make that choice.
Right.
And the person who is that is Kevin Feige. Right. I mean, they might give that to the director, but I think if it is a genuine disagreement, Feige's going to be the one to make the decision.
Yeah,
I don't know that 100% for sure, but I'd put that as a very high light because you are right. That is a really good point. The reason that you have a showrunner position is that you're like, okay, well, I get to make the final call. And on a movie, the director is going to make that final call. If the writer's like, that's not what I meant for the scene, Steven Spielberg's going to be like, well, it's what that scene's going to be now. Like that's how the movies work. And you are right that with Marvel on the movie side and the TV side, and a lot of people, like we said, especially early on, people didn't like that with Marvel movies, and this is now happening on the TV side, is no. Kevin Feige and Marvel are going to make that call.
Yeah, yeah. And I think sorry, Mike.
No, go ahead.
No, finish your point.
No, that was it.
Okay, I was just going to say one last thing, and that is, for all that talk about it landing or not landing or whatever, they're still new and making these kinds of shows. And you're right about COVID. You know, and other shows were able to do COVID because other shows have had the experience or the studios have had the experience. Marvel still figured out, you could argue, they did a pretty good job considering the situation and the strains that they were under overall. But I do find it ironic for Jock Shaver to say, well, it's too much for one person to handle. Kevin Feige is handling it, and he is the one person. So it's not really too much for one person to handle. It's more a matter of that within that particular story or show, it might be too much for one person to handle, but Kevin Feige is handling it overall. So,
but there is, I mean, yes, that is 100% true. But I think the reason Kevin Feige handles it is because he surrounds himself with the Waititis and the Russos and the Guns and
very
the
Scotlands
and the Spellmans and the Schaefers. And so I think, you know, you do want that good creative team around you. But, and the final thing I'll say about this, because I know we're wrapping up, like I do think where I do agree with the Marvel strategy and kind of Shannon talking about the CW shows makes me think about this is, look, I think, and I think Superman and Lois does a better job with this. And I think the network shows are catching up, but the action sequences in a broadcast superhero show are not the highlight of the show. They're good. Like you get, like, I think that Berlanti has done a lot and CW has done a lot to sort of push the envelope with the action sequences in Flash or Legends of Tomorrow or Arrow or any of them, but they're not on the scale of a fight on a truck through a road in Germany. Or, you know what I mean? Like they're not dealing with it. And I think that when you have a showrunner who's more focused on the writing and the character stuff, you're not always going to put that visual spectacle first. Yeah. And a director does put that visual spectacle first. And I think that this structure on the Marvel shows does sort of give equal weight to what the director is bringing to the table. And sometimes saying, look, I understand the story that you're telling, but like we need to make this look this way. This has to be huge. And so I do think, to your point about Feige doing all of it and covering it, I think maybe this is his way of making sure that those voices in the room on what's visually happening and how we're going to make this look is equal to what are they saying and what is this character arc and this character journey.
Yeah, absolutely. Shannon, any final words on this?
No. I'm still a burgeoning writer. I would love to work on a Marvel show.
Head writer on one Marvel property, what would it be?
It's already done.
I mean, something unannounced, I'm assuming, right?
Sure.
I'd be probably Young Avengers. Probably Young Avengers.
Yep. I know you didn't ask me, but I would take...
that was to both of you. That was an open question.
No, I mean, Moon Knight's already being done. That would have been my choice, so I'm excited for that overall. But I would go the other route with Shannon. I would go New Avengers. I loved New Avengers and would enjoy getting my hands on New Avengers and playing around with that lineup as well. For sure. It was always at the end of Comic-Con. I always went and bought whatever New Avengers compilations in hardback that were available there at the far end of the San Diego Convention Center. That was the cheapest you could find it. I know we got 1 minute, two news stories. Brooks, we're recording this. Sometimes we don't get to cover it real quick. Let's get some real quick thoughts, real quick seconds thoughts. Disney Jungle Cruise is now going to be released on July 30th, both on in the...
Ah! John froze!
Premier Axe announced that The Rock did. Thoughts?
You froze there at the end. So from it... July 30th, Disney Plus and theaters at the same time.
Yeah. Thoughts on they just announced it, July 30th, 2021.
I will be watching it in the theaters first. If it's really good, then I will maybe get it on Disney Plus.
All right.
I definitely want to see that. I definitely want to see that one in theaters. Also, I'm just excited to go to theaters. So, like, I will go see most of these movies that are coming out in the theater, and then I will go watch it on Disney Plus if I liked it. But I know that I'm in the minority here, but... I'm excited for Jungle Cruise. I think it looks like a blast.
I do too. It's The Rock. So I'm excited to see it any way I can get it. So I'm excited to see them. And I like that this is going back to the theaters. People going back to theaters. And one last thing, EW dropped the first look at Henry Golding as Snake. There it is, doing his thing for the G.I. Joe universe. You want to talk? Look at this. Look at this. Look. And then here we go, right here. Look at this one, right there. Look at that sweetness. Overall, so I like the look. I like the aspect of it. What do you got?
Well, Snake Eyes wears a mask.
Oh, how dare you! How dare you!
I am open to a new interpretation on Snake Eyes. I will say that, like, the thing that made Snake Eyes so cool was the fact that we never did see his face or hear him. And obviously, I want to see Henry Golding's face. It is a gorgeous face. So I'm curious to see, Hasbro/Paramount has not had the biggest success with G.I. Joe. Mm-hmm. Having worked on G.I. Joe Renegades with Hasbro, I have a lot of opinions on Hasbro's thoughts on G.I. Joe. So I am curious to see where this goes.
And that last picture, John, that was Andrew Koji, right?
Yes, Andrew Koji.
Yeah.
Sorry, just pictures from Snake Eyes G.I. Joe Origins. So I just wanted to give a little love to Henry Golding as well, because I'm really becoming a huge Henry Golding fan. So
yeah,
fantastic. Yeah. Andrew Koji is Storm Shadow. That's why I will see that movie.
Yeah, it looks badass. All right, there you go. Thank you all so much for watching this episode of the Geek Buddies. We got to get out of here. Shannon, what do we got
to
tell them?
Yeah, if you'd like to follow us on social media, on Twitter, it's @Geek_Buddies. On Instagram, @The_Geek_Buddies. If you'd like to follow me on social media, on Twitter, it's @Shannon_McClung. On Instagram, @ShannonTheGeekBuddy. If you would like to follow Mr. Vogel, it is @MKToon. If you would like to follow Mr. Roca, it is @TheRocaSays.
Mikey.
All right, hit that like button below. Subscribe to Johnny's Outlaw Nation page. Lots of awesome content, including stuff starring us truly. Let us know what you thought in the comments below. Who do you want to see in Knives Out 2? Did He-Man make you gay? Let us know. We want to find out the truth. What else? Let us know. What do you think of this Marvel situation? What do you think of the Marvel structure? Like, let us know in the comments. We love to talk about it. If you're listening to us on Anchor or Spotify or Apple Podcasts, leave us some comments there. Don't forget that you can search for us on any of the podcast channels. Just type in Geek Buddies. You will find us, and then you can take us on the go and listen to us while you run your errands or run around the track, whatever you want to do. And then the best thing that you guys can do is share this video, retweet this video, post it on your Facebook page, text it to your friends. Let's get as many buddies going as possible. It's going to be a party.
Absolutely. Don't forget. We got ourselves a little Bad Batch reviews coming up this week as well. Episode 3 dropping. If you have missed our episode 1, episode 2 reviews, Laura Kelly, they're out there for you to watch or listen to. So come and tune in later on this week, probably this weekend, for episode 3 spoiler review as well. All right, we're out of here. Much love to you. Take care, everybody. Hope you get vaccinated and take care of yourselves. And we'll talk to you next time with another brand new episode of the
Geek
Buddies.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.